Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 158. It's Monday, April 11th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get right to it. Let's start with a gee, I didn't see that one coming story. This from CBS News. Airlines that drop mask requirements are now suffering staff shortages due to COVID-19. Overseas airlines are having to cancel hundreds of flights as they grapple with coronavirus-related staffing shortages, weeks after they ditched rules requiring passengers and staff to mask up in the air. The disruptions also came as the CEOs of leading U.S. airlines urged the Biden administration to roll back a federal rule requiring that masks be worn in the sky. Masks have not been required on flights operated by budget-friendly Swiss airline EasyJet since March 27th. The airline said in a statement, the move came after the UK removed all travel restrictions earlier in March. Between March 28th and April 3rd, EasyJet canceled 202 of its 3,500 flights scheduled to depart from the UK, according to data provided by CBS MoneyWatch. By comparison, the carrier canceled zero flights departing from the UK during the same period in 2019 before the pandemic. An EasyJet spokesman attributed the increase in canceled flights to higher than usual staff sickness levels due to a recent surge in COVID-19 cases across Europe. According to Dr. Eric Fiegeldang, an epidemiologist and health economist, such flight cancellations are all but guaranteed once passengers and crew members took off their masks. So damn predictable. UK government drops restrictions, airlines like EasyJet drops mask, and less than 2 weeks later, huge spike in pilots and flight attendants out sick with COVID, unable to work, and 120 flights canceled. Airline CEOs asked for this, he said on Twitter. A similar move by U.S. airlines would backfire in many ways, Fiegeldang told CBS MoneyWatch. He thinks more passengers would hesitate to fly if airlines ditch mask rules. If there are no masks, that actually makes people more worried about taking a trip. It might make more people stay home and bite the airlines, he said. Although staffing shortages related to COVID-19 rates in Europe are disrupting other sectors, they're particularly acute in the airline industry. It's very clear that the airline industry is particularly vulnerable, and this creates a cascading effect on society more than, say, a restaurant closing would. This is critical infrastructure, and these are essential employees, and we're endangering our economy. Stopping COVID is good for our economy. Letting it rip is the exact opposite. Yeah, so people don't want to live with COVID, but of course they don't want to live with airline cancellations. The problem is people don't want to live with the consequences of their actions. Wow, what a wonderful world that would be. No consequences to our actions. Yeah, if we were all a bunch of infantile babies and no adults around, but that's not the case, hopefully. Okay, well, next up, from the school of, if we don't measure it, it's probably not happening, this from NBC News. Incomplete data likely masks a rise in U.S. COVID cases as focus on infection counts fades. At first glance, U.S. COVID cases appear to have plateaued over the past 2 weeks, with a consistent average of around 30,000 cases per day. But disease experts say incomplete data likely masks an upward trend. I do think we're in the middle of a surge, the magnitude of which I can't tell you, Zeke Emanuel, Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, said. Emanuel and other experts cite a lack of testing as the primary reason cases go underreported. At the height of the Omicron wave in January, the U.S. was administering more than 2 million tests per day. That had dropped to an average of about 530,000 as of last Monday. the most recent data from the Centers for CDC said. The milder symptoms become, the less likely people are to test or show up in official case counts, said David Dowdy, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. More people also now have access to at-home rapid tests that are free and covered by insurance, and most of these test results don't get reported to state health departments or the CDC. Case counts and testing are progressively becoming shaky indicators because we're not catching everyone in the system, said Dr. Jonathan Quick, an adjunct professor at the Duke Global Health Institute. Some local data, however, does reveal recent spikes. Average COVID cases have risen nearly 80% in Nebraska, 75% in Arizona, 58% in New York, and 55% in Massachusetts over the past 2 weeks. Wastewater surveillance similarly suggests that infections are rising in Colorado, Ohio, and Washington, among other states. But some experts believe it's no longer crucial to track every case now that infections are mostly mild for vaccinated people. Moving forward, Dowdy said, it makes more sense for both health officials and careful citizens to pay attention to hospitalizations. The CDC's revised masking guidance already relies on county-level hospitalizations rates and capacities. Others believe differently. Once we see hospitalizations going up, that's already the back half of the train, said Carrie Althoff, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. At that point, it takes time to slow things down. Yeah, it's what I call caboose surveillance. The people most at risk because of the U.S.'s artificially low case counts are the immunocompromised and children under 5 who are not yet eligible for vaccines. Experts said those groups or their caregivers should still have a way to accurately gauge transmission in their communities. We're going to continue to see outbreaks, so we're constantly going to have to assess our individual risks and do more to protect people in our communities who are vulnerable. Okay, with that, let's get to the Lucas County COVID-19 update. Looks like we had a big tick up. You might even call it a spike, but like the previous story says, with testing, it's a little unreliable. But of course, more positive tests is usually a bad thing. We move up to 63 confirmed COVID-19 tests per day in the last week, up from 12 last week. So a big jump. The testing positive rate stayed about the same in Lucas County. They're at 2%. Although the testing positivity rates in Ohio and the U.S. have gone up, they went up from 2.3 to 2.7% in Ohio, although I would note that Ohio no longer posts its test positivity rates on the Ohio Department of Health COVID-19 site. Not sure why that is. Again, they're probably preparing for the pandemic to be over. I can get that data from the CDC as well, though. So that's where that data is from. And from the U.S., the national testing positivity rate went up from 2.7% to 3.2%. So last week I had talked about how we had probably bottomed out as far as tests and we're on our way back up. This week seems to confirm that, both locally and statewide and nationally. Okay, well, and really good news from the long-term care facilities in Lucas County. Only had one active COVID case identified, and that was actually among a staff, not a resident. Woohoo! That's like got to be a new record for the whole freaking pandemic. Very good. UT did see a rise in cases, though, up to 13 identified cases from 6 in the previous week. So we're seeing that trend that's reflected in the community numbers there showing up in UT. New hospitalizations are still slowly declining in Ohio, though the United States new hospitalization rate may be bottoming out and perhaps reversing. If it looks like we're seeing a rise in cases some places, we may see the eventual reversal and getting more new hospitalizations. Okay, well, deaths nationally are still dropping. It slowed down a bit, but we're down to under 600 deaths per day. Although I will note, this is still the number 3 leading cause of death in the U.S. today. It's getting down to that territory, though, where it might drop to 4. Let's hope it keeps dropping and doesn't just level off. Okay, that does it for the local report. Let's move on to a story that gets at how we have to change our behavior and understanding the virus as the virus changes. This from CNN. In Washington's COVID-19 outbreak, new variant flouts old close contact rule. Washington, D.C. is coping with a cluster of high-profile COVID-19 cases after a series of public events exposed high-level officials. Health experts say the outbreak may be rooted in part in outdated and confusing guidelines from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that help people assess their risk of getting the virus that causes COVID-19 or passing it on to others. Last Thursday, after announcing that she had been in close contact with someone who had tested positive for COVID-19, Vice President Kamala Harris presided over the Senate confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson without wearing a mask, though CDC guidelines advise masking around other people for at least 10 days after exposure to the virus. That same day, at a press event for World Health Day, Javier Becerra, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, explained that he and the World Health Organization director would both be wearing masks at the event, except while speaking, quote, because each of us has been close to someone who tested positively recently. Health experts say that Americans are relying on CDC guidance that's overdue for an update. Since the early days of the pandemic, the CDC has defined someone who's a close contact and is therefore at risk of contracting and spreading the virus as someone who has spent a cumulative total of at least 15 minutes within 6 feet of another person who has lab-confirmed COVID-19 or who's been told they have COVID by a doctor. With newer and more contagious variants such as the BA.2 on the loose, Kimberly Prather, an aerosol scientist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, said the rule needs rethinking. 15 minutes and 6 feet was not really useful in the first place, she noted. We know people get infected in less time and longer distanced. Prather thinks the rule for close contact should be based on anyone sharing the air in a room for a certain number of minutes. Distance, specifically the distance of 6 feet, has been the infection equation since the late 1800s, when a scientist named Carl Flug figured out that infections could be transmitted by respiratory droplets through the air. He recommended separating people to prevent infections. Scientists tested it using glass plates and came up with a distance of 6 feet. In the 1930s, another scientist, William Wells, figured out that although some droplets that come from the mouth or nose are large and fall to the ground quickly, within 3 to 6 feet, sick people can also emit smaller virus-filled aerosols that float in the air for minutes or even hours. Those can also be infectious. Yet the CDC continues to factor 6 feet into its risk equations. In response to a question from CNN, a CDC spokesperson last Thursday said that the agency was not planning to change the close contact definition, quote, at this time. If you were part of an event where there is multiple infections, you will have been exposed. I don't care if it's 6 feet or 15, said Dr. Carlos Del Rio, an infectious disease specialist at Emory University. If you're exposed but up to date in your vaccinations, Del Rio said, you should watch for symptoms and wear a mask for 10 days, which is what the CDC says too. If I was in that room with Pelosi and others where they got infected, I would consider myself a close contact because I was there, he said. That's closer to the way some other countries have defined exposure. Until February, when the UK began to roll back its pandemic restrictions, health authorities were there defined a close contact more broadly. Their definition included anyone who lives with someone who tests positive, has face-to-face contact or a conversation within about 3 feet of someone who has tested positive, has been within 3 feet for 1 minute or longer, regardless of whether the contact was face-to-face, has spent more than 15 minutes within 6 feet of someone who tested positive, has traveled in the same vehicle or plane with a positive case. Lindsay Marr, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech University, who studies aerosols, said the CDC needs to take another look at its contact precautions. I do think that they should update it, because I think it's based on outdated thinking about transmission, she said. Marr said the CDC probably made the cutoffs of 6 feet and 15 minutes, to try to make the best use of limited public health resources, such as contact tracing. It's based more on convenience than on science at this point, she said. Marr said that all super spreading events have four things in common: lots of talking, shouting, or singing, long exposure times, poor ventilation, and no masks. If you have that type of situation, then I would say everyone in the room is potentially exposed, she said. Well, while most people can agree that exposure to COVID-19 can in fact be dangerous, one thing that hasn't been fully determined is whether exposure to Donald Trump is always dangerous. Here seems to be a study where exposure to Donald Trump is actually a good thing. This is a study entitled Using Donald Trump's COVID-19 Vaccine Endorsement to Give Public Health a Shot in the Arm, a Large-Scale Ad Experiment. We report a large-scale randomized controlled trial designed to assess whether the partisan cue of pro-vaccine message from Donald Trump would induce Americans to get COVID-19 vaccines. Our study involved presenting a 27-second advertisement to millions of U.S. tube users in October 2021. Results indicate that the campaign increased the number of vaccine in the average treated county by 103. Spread across the over 1,000 treated counties, the total effect of the campaign was an estimated increase in over 104,000 vaccines. The campaign was cost-effective, with an overall budget of around $100,000, so the cost to obtain an additional vaccine was about $1 or less. Whew. That's way more cost-effective than many of these other kind of crazy incentives that people have put out. And this really speaks to the fact that we missed an opportunity by really trying to leverage those Republicans. We're not just a few, certainly a lot of particularly high-profile Republicans got vaccinated but did not speak forcefully for vaccination, and it's a real missed opportunity. Okay, well, this next story from Kaiser Health News gets to the fact that healthcare infrastructure is important. A shortfall of ECMO treatment costs lives during the Delta surge. ECMO is a last-ditch life support treatment in which a machine outside the body does the work of the hearts and lungs. The results published in the American Journal of Respiratory Care, Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine are grim. Nearly 90% who couldn't find a spot at an ECMO center died. And these patients were under 60 and previously healthy, with a median age of 40. Over the course of the pandemic, hospitals have had difficulty deciding who gets priority when ECMO, which stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, is in short supply. It's not an exact science, and there are precious few ECMO beds, especially when some patients linger for months on the machine only to die. While the odds of survival with critical COVID patients are still roughly 50-50, the Vanderbilt study shows that what happens if the therapy is unavailable, with about 90% dying. I'm trying to convince people that this is a resource worth investing in, and then hope people invest in those resources over time, said the study's senior author. Until there is broader access to ECMO, the country also needs to find a better way to decide who is prioritized for treatment, similar to how organ transplant allocation works. There's a national ECMO organization, but it doesn't get involved with triaging patients yet. It takes a lot of cooperation among health systems and state leadership, but I think doctors and communities have more appetite for that now than they did before. I hope that's true. Well, this one's for those folks who are more scared of COVID vaccinations than they are of COVID. They often look to thrombosis and heart events, but here's one from MedPage Today that really refutes that belief. COVID-19 tied to high risk of thrombotic events. COVID-19 was associated with a greater risk of for a host of thrombotic events in the months following a patient's infection, a large study in Sweden found. Among over 1 million people who tested positive for COVID-19 in the past month, risk for a first pulmonary embolism was 33 times higher compared with a matched control group after adjusting for multiple potential confounders. Meanwhile, the risk for a first deep vein thrombosis was 5 times higher, and the risk of bleeding was nearly twice as high, according to their findings in the British Medical Journal. Yes, folks, COVID-19 is dangerous, and many, 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 many times more dangerous, certainly, than COVID-19 vaccinations. Okay, well, next up, from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy from the University of Minnesota, something we've been learning, unfortunately, through COVID-19 as well. COVID-19 health workers suffer combat-type moral trauma. A Duke University study shows that amid COVID-19, U.S. healthcare workers had similar rates of potential moral injury, a type of trauma-induced wound to the psyche, as military combat veterans. Potential moral injury is a distressing reaction to exposure to traumatic events that may have psychological, behavioral, social, and spiritual effects. Of the 618 veterans, 46% reported experiencing potential moral injury induced by others' immoral actions, compared to about 51% of healthcare workers, while 24% of healthcare workers and 18% of combat victims reported being disturbed by violations of their own moral code. Combat veterans who reported potential moral injuries had higher rates of depression. They also had lower quality of life. Moral injuries can happen when healthcare workers' values and beliefs conflict with their actions or the ways they witness others acting. While burnout is often used to describe the effects of ongoing stress in the workplace, moral injury is used to describe the damage done to the conscience or identity of people who might witness, cause, or fail to prevent acts that go against their own moral standards. For example, with healthcare workers, this might entail them making choices or being part of a situation that strays from their genuine commitment to healing. This was reported from witnessing patient deaths, rationed care, policies that kept families from dying patients, and the public's disregard for slowing COVID-19 transmission. It was also triggered by staff shortages and a lack of personal protective equipment. It is sobering to see how many healthcare workers are troubled at a moral level because of their work experiences during the pandemic. This may help us to understand some of the current challenges facing healthcare systems across the country. Okay, well, next up, got a story on one of the most basic indicators of population health, which is life expectancy, which continues to drop in this country. And this is really important since we actually had our first drop, I think it was in 2015. And we don't live in our parents' America. We don't live in our parents' parents' America. We don't live in our parents' 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 America. Life expectancy has been increasing consistently for a century, and now we're seeing reversals. The only reversals I think we saw over that period other than recently was in World War II, when you had massive amounts of young people dying in war. Another example, of course, that war is a public health issue and can kill you. Okay, this from CNN. U.S. life expectancy continues historic decline with another drop in 2021. Life expectancy in the United States took another hit in 2021, furthering a dramatic decline from 2020 that was the largest since World War II, according to a new report. The study found that after falling nearly 1.9 years in 2020, life expectancy in the U.S. decreased another 0.4 years in 2021 as COVID-19 continued to spread. With a brief exception in the summer of 2021, COVID-19 has consistently been one of the top three causes of death over the past 2 years in the U.S. In the decade before the pandemic, life expectancy in the U.S. changed by an average of less than 0.1 years annually, according to data from the CDC. Changes to life expectancy amid the COVID-19 pandemic widened an existing gap between the U.S. and other high-income countries, the new report shows. Among a set of 19 peer countries, life expectancy dropped only a third as much as in the U.S. in 2020, down 0.6 years on average, and then rebounded in 2021 with an average increase of about 0.3 years. Life expectancy in the U.S., however, though, fell from 78.9 years in 2019 to 76.6 years in 2021, now more than 5 years less than the average among peer nations. This speaks volumes about the life consequences of how the U.S. handled the pandemic, said Dr. Stephen Wolf, study author and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. What happened in the U.S. is less about the variants than the levels of resistance to vaccination and the public's rejections of practices, such as masking and mandates to reduce viral transmission. In the U.S., there was a disproportionate decrease in life expectancy for Black and Hispanic people in 2020, but in 2021, white people had the largest losses, with life expectancy holding steady for Hispanic people and rising slightly for Black people. Yes, folks, that was a kind of a self-inflicted wound there, huh? White folks being the most likely to ignore pandemic restrictions and vaccinations. Okay, well, let's switch gears and move to a broader public health issue. This from the Associated Press. The World Health Organization says 99% of world's population breathes poor quality air. The UN Health Agency says nearly everybody in the world breathes air that doesn't meet its standards for air quality, calling for more action to reduce fossil fuel use, which generates pollutants that cause respiratory and blood flow problems that lead to millions of preventable deaths each year. The World Health Organization said 99% of the global population breathes air that exceeds its air quality limits and is often rife with particles that can penetrate deep into the lungs, enter the veins and arteries, and cause disease. Air quality is poorest in the Eastern Mediterranean and Southeast Asia regions, followed by Africa, the World Health Organization said. After surviving a pandemic, it is unacceptable to still have 7 million preventable deaths and countless preventable lost years of good health due to air pollution, said Dr. Maria Niera, head of the World Health Organization's Department of Environment, Climate Change, and Health. Yet too many investments are still being sunk into a polluted environment rather than in clean, healthy air. Yes, folks, a basic thing that us humans share in public health is that we all need to breathe, drink water, and eat. And honing a little bit on air quality for the poorest around the world, this from Science Daily, world's vulnerable are being polluted in their own homes as they cook. 3/4 of kitchens in low-income homes across 12 major global cities are heavily polluted by cooking emissions, according to research from the University of Surrey and its global partners. The first-of-its-kind study found that poor ventilation and fuel choices were the most significant contributors to poor air quality in people's kitchens. But the size of the kitchen and the way food was cooked also mattered. Frying food led to particularly high levels of indoor pollution. There's a notable wealth divide when it comes to indoor air quality, and also a gender divide, as women are typically disproportionately impacted by pollution caused by cooking, especially in the developing world. This problem must be addressed to improve health and equality. The World Health Organization estimates that approximately 4 million people die prematurely from illnesses attributed to indoor air pollution caused by polluting stoves, operating on solid fuels and kerosene. Exposure to high levels of particulate matter, including that from cooking, has been linked to health conditions including heart disease, pneumonia, stroke, lung cancer, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And while that may not affect a lot of us in this country, one personal tip I suppose you could take from that is fry foods less, because that produces a lot of the indoor air pollution and is usually a pretty good nutritional indicator as well. Okay, well, let's return back to America. Let's focus on some of our seniors. This from Medical Express. Half of older adults now die with a dementia diagnosis, up sharply from 2 decades ago. Nearly half of all older adults now die with a diagnosis of dementia listed on their medical record, up from 36% from 2 decades ago. But that sharp rise may have more to do with better public awareness, more detailed medical records, and Medicare billing practice than an actual rise in the condition, the researchers say. Even so, they note, this offers a chance for more older adults to talk in advance with their families and healthcare providers about the kind of care they want at the end of life if they do develop Alzheimer's disease or another form of cognitive decline. The biggest jump in the percentage of people dying with a dementia diagnosis happened around the time Medicare allowed hospitals, hospices, and doctors' offices to list more diagnoses on their requests for payments. But around the same time, the National Plan to Address Alzheimer's Disease also went into effect, with a focus on public awareness, quality of care, and more support for patients and their caregivers. Yeah, I was just struck the fact that half of us in America apparently will end up dying with a diagnosis of dementia of some form. Yikes. And turning to the state of nursing homes, this is from the Associated Press. Nursing home care funding system need overhaul, report says. Nursing home residents are subjected to ineffective care and poor staffing, while facility finances are shrouded in secrecy and regulatory lapses go unenforced, according to a report that called for wholesale changes in an industry whose failure has been spotlighted by the pandemic. To anyone who saw the scourge of COVID-19 in the country's most vulnerable, the findings of the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine might seem sobering but unsurprising, as the long-term care system's inadequacies were made plain by more than 150,000 resident deaths. The authors of the 605-page report insisted it could be an impetus to address issues that have gotten little more than lip service for decades. The public is so concerned about the quality of care that most people really fear their family having to be in a nursing home, said Betty Farrell, a nurse who chaired the report committee. We're very optimistic that our government officials respond to what has really been a travesty. The report covers a vast cross-section of long-term care, from granular details such as the way facilities are designed to foundational issues that would require massive political capital and investment to address. Among them, the authors advocate for creating a new national long-term care system that would exist outside of Medicaid, the program that is at the center of most long-term care financing. The likelihood of such a proposal successfully winding its way through Congress seems low in the current political environment. On the issue of nursing home staffing, which advocates have repeatedly said is too low, too untrained, and too underpaid, the report's authors call for facilities to have at least one registered nurse on duty at all times, and for an infection prevention and control specialist and social worker to also be on staff. More broadly, across all staffing in homes, including nurse aides who make up the bulk of frontline caregivers, the authors call for additional study on optimal staffing. Industry lobbyists have fiercely fought against more stringent staffing requirements. Federal law only requires nursing homes to have sufficient staff to meet residents' need, but nearly all interpretation of what that means is left to states. President Joe Biden, too, has called for establishing national staffing minimums. Among the more routine subjects in the report, but one that nonetheless impacts residents' everyday lives, the authors call for homes to prioritize private rooms and bathrooms instead of the communal ones that can fuel infections and underscore the institutional setting. And in a blunt reminder of how bleak life in nursing homes can be, the report notes most residents spend little, if any, time outdoors, calling for facilities to make outside access more accessible. The proposals have the potential to improve the days of residents who, even when they're having their basic medical needs met, are frequently lacking in other areas of their lives. The average nursing home resident has an okay quality of care, but a poor quality of life. Advocates for nursing home residents have long pleaded for attention on homes' shortcomings, and the pandemic gave them a media spotlight. But decades of inaction by politicians and the resistance by the industry are difficult to overcome, and what the report might spark remains unclear. A forerunner of the study, 1986's Improving the Quality of Care in Nursing Homes, was also a product of the National Academies. Some issues of the report were taken on in the sweeping 1987 Nursing Home Reform Act, which created the regulatory framework homes are still under today. Others remain unaddressed 36 years later. Okay, well, sticking with aging, but shifting to diet, here's an interesting story from Medical Express. Vegan diet eases arthritis pain, finds new study. A low-fat vegan diet without calorie restrictions improves joint pain in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, according to a new study conducted by researchers at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and published in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. Study participants also experienced weight loss and improved cholesterol levels. A plant-based diet could be the prescription to alleviate joint pain for millions of people suffering from rheumatoid arthritis, says Neil Bernard, lead author of the study. And all of the side effects, including weight loss and lower cholesterol, are only beneficial. Rheumatoid arthritis is a common autoimmune disease that typically causes joint pain, swelling, and eventually permanent joint damage. Note that actually it's less than 20% of the people that have arthritis have rheumatoid, which is a more inflammatory form of arthritis. Osteoarthritis, which is the most common type of arthritis, this doesn't speak to that, but that's often a product of disuse, meaning move it or lose it. Exercise can help prevent the effects of osteoarthritis. Well, folks, chronic diseases start young. This from the Washington Post. Over a quarter of 12 to 19-year-olds have prediabetes, research shows. U.S. residents on the cusp of developing type 2 diabetes include about 28% of youths aged 12 to 9, according to research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics. They have a condition known as prediabetes, which means that the level of sugar or glucose in the blood is higher than normal, but not high enough to be diagnosed as having full-fledged diabetes. The researchers found that the percentage of youths with prediabetes has more than doubled in recent years, going from just under 12% in 1999 to 28% in 2018. It was found to be more prevalent among boys and girls and among youths who are overweight or obese. Among adults, about 96 million, or more than 1 in 3, have prediabetes, according to the CDC. At any age, people with prediabetes are not only more likely to progress to type 2 diabetes, but are also at higher risk for heart disease. Also, most people who have prediabetes do not know it because the condition usually has no symptoms. Health experts say the medication may sometimes be needed to manage blood sugar levels, but for others, lifestyle changes, including a healthier diet, regular physical activity, and if needed, weight loss, may prevent diabetes from developing. Okay, and moving to a story about another common major risk factor for ill health, this from Medical Express. Examining the link between blood pressure and emotions. In an article published in the Annals of Behavioral Medicine, researchers show that compared to a healthy control group, men with essential hypertension, that means hypertension that has no traditional risk factors identified, are more often they recognize angry expressions when they looked into the faces of others. In addition, this anger recognition bias seems to contribute to blood pressure increases over time if someone tends to frequently, intensively experience anger. This tendency is called trait anger. Hypertensive men recognize anger more often than any other emotion, so they overrated anger displayed in other people's faces as compared to our healthy control group. Overrating anger displayed by other persons seems to affect whether high trait anger contributes to blood pressure increases over time. Hence, interpersonal factors seem to play a role in essential hypertension. What about women? The researchers hope that future studies will include women, since women may possibly differ in their emotion recognition from men, and as fewer women suffer from hypertension, the study initially focused on men. Okay, and sticking to the angry, perhaps scared category, this from Medical Express. Study finds higher homicide risk in homes with handguns. Most U.S. gun owners say they own firearms to protect themselves and their loved ones, surveys show. But a recent study suggests people who live with handgun owners are shot to death at a higher rate than those who don't have such weapons at home. We found zero evidence of any kind of protective effect from living in a home with a handgun, said David Studer, a Stanford University researcher who is the lead author of the Annals of Internal Medicine study. The study focused on nearly 600,000 Californians who did not own handguns but began living in homes with handguns between October 2004 and December 2016, either because they started living with someone who owned one or because someone in their household bought one. The researchers calculated that for every 100,000 people in that situation, 12 will be shot to death by someone else over 5 years. In comparison, 8 out of the 100,000 who live in gun-free homes will be killed that way over the same time span. So that's about a 50% greater risk in living in a home with a handgun. These are handguns, by the way, not just all guns. Those numbers suggest the risk rises 50%, but Studer said it's actually higher. In a separate calculation designed to better account for where people live and other factors, the researchers estimated the risk was actually more than twice as high. Separately, the researchers found that those who lived with handgun owners had a much higher rate of being fatally shot by a spouse or intimate partner. The vast majority of such victims, 84%, were women, they said. The study was confined to California, but the risk is likely even greater in states with less stringent gun laws and where gun ownership is more common. Previous research estimated that nearly 3% of U.S. adults became new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021, which translates to about 7.5 million Americans. Of those, about 5.5 million previously lived in a home with no guns. For decades, studies have shown guns in the home raise the risk of violent death. Much of that work focused on suicide. The new study goes further in addressing the misguided perception that handguns are still worthwhile because of the safety they provide against being murdered, some experts said. The reason people have guns in the home is for protection from strangers, said David Hemenway, director of the Harvard University's Injury Control Research Center. But what this is showing, that having a gun in the home is bad for people in the home. And in another gun violence story, this from Medical Express, survivors of gun violence and their families face increased risk of mental health disorders, higher health care spending. While 40,000 people in the United States are killed by firearms each year, an estimated 85,000 people survive firearm injuries. A new study shows that the repercussions of such trauma extend far beyond the immediate aftermath of the injury. The analysis, based on examination of patient records over 10 years, shows that people who survive a firearm injury face greater risk of mental health disorders, substance use disorders, and pain in the year following injury. The immediate family members of survivors also appear to suffer indirect but tangible harms. The significant others, parents, and children of gunshot survivors showed an increased risk of mental health problems, including depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Overall, gunshot survivors had a 40% increase in pain diagnoses, a 51% increase in psychiatric disorders, and an 85% increase in substance use disorders after firearm injury compared to peers who had not sustained gunshot wounds. Family members has a 12% increase in psychiatric disorders relative to their match peers, the researchers found. Well, folks, you're listening to Just for the Health of It here on 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, broadcasting from the John Snow Memorial Studio. Okay, and another story regarding living in the wake of violence, this from the 19th. Leaving victims with the bill. Sexual assault survivors are often charged hundreds of dollars for rape kits. The Violence Against Women Act requires states to bear the cost of rape kit exams, but hospitals don't always know that or have the right people to work with victims. $347. That was the average out-of-pocket cost for sexual assault survivors who received forensic exam services as part of a rape kit from 2016 to 2018, the Kaiser Family Foundation found. Under federal law, they weren't supposed to pay anything at all. The Violence Against Women Act, reauthorized last month as part of the Congress's omnibus spending bill, requires states to bear full out-of-pocket costs of forensic medical exams to receive federal funds for law enforcement agencies, courts, and victim services. Even if victims are fully reimbursed later, states that allow hospitals to charge patients are still violating the requirements laid out for them by the Justice Department to access these funds. But not everyone who interacts with a survivor, including hospital and emergency department staff, knows that. As a result, a patchwork of state laws and a nationwide shortage of specially trained and trauma-informed examiners has led to sexual assault survivors often being billed for forensic exams that should be free, experts tell the 19th. It's one more burden placed on people already dealing with the trauma of not just assault, but also the repercussions that can come with seeking help. After experiencing rape or sexual assault, survivors can request a rape kit examination. The process is often needed to get medical care or to take evidence to the police and often allows survivors to talk to someone about what happened. A survivor can refuse any parts of the exam, including genital swabs. Giving the survivor control over the exam is crucial in the healing process, said Jen McNew, a forensic nurse consultant in Maryland. Their body is the crime scene and where the evidence obviously has to be collected, McNew said. After survivors potentially relive the trauma that they just went through during a forensic exam, they may also unexpectedly be billed for it. From 2016 to 2018, when the previous version of the Violence Against Women Act was in place, two-thirds of privately insured women in the United States who received a rape kit were charged out-of-pocket costs for forensic exam services. The bill may go unnoticed or the survivor may not realize what it is, said Barbara Schaefer, a medical advocacy coordinator at the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. When a survivor is dealt an unexpected medical bill for care they sought after being assaulted, they may simply not have the emotional capacity to deal with it on top of everything else they are going through. I have dealt with a few situations where it did not get paid and then it was sent to collections. And that is very challenging to try to get that corrected, said Schaefer, who works with sexual assault nurse examiners and advocates at rape crisis centers across the state. A nationwide shortage of sexual assault nurse examiners, also known as SANEs, is a key part of why survivors are being left with bills that they should not have to pay, experts tell the 19th. SANEs, nurses who are trained to work with survivors of sexual assault, are usually the most qualified person to administer a rape kit in the hospital and actually know how to navigate the billing process to keep survivors from getting charged. We kind of facilitate the entire process when they're here, said McNew, who has been a SANE practitioner since 25. But there is lots of hospitals that have no forensic nurses. The unexpected bills boil down to a training and policy issue within hospitals. When people in the billing department just don't know what they should do and the hospital haven't made policies clear to staff. The Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women, which oversees grant programs authorized by the Violence Against Women Act, advises states receiving federal funding in the law that medical providers do need to have specialized sexual assault forensic training to administer a rape kit exam, although states can determine what exactly that training should be. That specification implies that states are not obligated to cover forensic exams if they are not conducted by a SANE or similarly licensed medical professional. The shortages of SANEs can also add additional financial burdens onto survivors. Teresa Stafford, executive director of the Hope and Healing Survivor Resource Center in Ohio, which runs a rape crisis and battered women's shelter for Summit and Medina counties, said that in her area, survivors are being burdened with transportation costs to reach a SANE. In the rural area of Ashtabula, Ohio, some survivors need to travel to a hospital two counties away to reach someone qualified to administer the examinations in a rape kit, she said. If somebody's not trained, they are reading the instructions off the box, step by step. You wouldn't be comfortable with somebody providing that type of medical treatment to you in any other situation, so survivors deserve better, she said. Schaefer said that sometimes, even after an examination by a SANE is correctly charged to a state's Victims Compensation Assistance Program, a patient can still receive a physician's bill after a doctor checked up on them that day. That's not allowable, but that was happening, she said. While some states have tried to clean up the process to keep victims from having to foot the bill, the end result is still an inconsistent patchwork quilt of laws. The larger gray zone of medical services that sexual assault victims are being charged, in addition to forensic medical exam, is also important to keep in mind when considering all the burdens that victims face, said Alina Soganakoff, Kaiser Family Foundation Senior Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy. Survivors are often charged for other forms of medical care during their hospital visit. Most states do not cover these additional services like x-rays, pregnancy tests, MRAs, sexually transmitted infection testing, prescriptions, ambulance fees, and additional doctor's visits. In addition to placing more financial burdens on survivors, those charges can endanger them. When a charge shows up on a survivor's insurance or is mailed to their home, hospitals may be alerting victims' assailants that they have just sought help. Staffordshire says she has seen that situation play out before, where the perpetrator is on a shared insurance policy with a victim. We know a lot of times people are sexually assaulted. They're often sexually assaulted by someone they know, love, and trust, and that individual can be right in their household, she said. Yikes. Okay, in another story showing how women's lives and health is devalued in America, this from the Associated Press. Social programs weak in many states with tough abortion laws. States with some of the nation's strictest abortion laws are often some of the hardest places to have and raise a healthy child, especially for the poor, according to analysis of federal data by the Associated Press. The findings raise questions about the strength of the social safety net, as those states are poised to further restrict or even ban abortion access following an expected U.S. Supreme Court decision later this year. The burden is likely to fall heaviest on those with low incomes, who also are the least able to seek an abortion in another state where the procedures remain widely available. The Associated Press analyzed figures from several federal government agencies in seven categories, metrics identified by several nonprofits and experts as essential to determining whether children get a healthy start. They were the percentage of children in poverty, participation in the Women, Infants, and Children Federal Assistance Program, the rate of child abuse or neglect, women experiencing intimate partner violence during pregnancy, low birth weight, women receiving no prenatal care in their first trimester, and uninsured children in poverty. Generally, states with preemptive abortion bans or laws that greatly restrict abortion access showed the worst rankings. Alabama and Louisiana joined Mississippi as the top three states with the highest percentage of babies born with low birth weights. Texas, Indiana, and Mississippi had the highest percentage of women receiving no prenatal care during the first trimester. Wyoming, Texas, and Utah had the highest percentage of poor children 18 and younger who had no health insurance. The reason why people seek abortions are complex, but financial concerns are often a top factor, according to research by Diana Green Foster, a professor of reproductive science at the University of California, San Francisco. Children born to women who were denied an abortion and carried the pregnancy to term are more likely to live in a household where there isn't enough money for basic living expenses, her work has found. When a woman can get abortions, the children they do have fare better. So there's a clear effect on poverty, but there's also an effect on child development. In states with strict abortion laws, performance on measurements such as access to health insurance for low-income people is linked in part to political realities. Leaders who have supported abortion restrictions for decades generally have espoused small government principles and opposed measures such as Medicaid expansion, said legal historian Mary Ziegler at Florida State University's law school. The pro-life movement has made its political bones by relying on the GOP, she said. The GOP has not been in favor of expanding the social safety net for young children and pregnant people. And the pro-life movement, which may have otherwise wanted to do that, is not willing to expend political capital on that because its priority is abortion, basically, and nothing beyond it. Yeah, folks, well, so much for family values. Well, and in case you missed it, this from NPR, patriarchy is global. Men, especially from rich countries, still fill the boards of global health groups. The world of global health leadership is still very much a man's world. That's the conclusion of a new report published by Global Health 5050. The title, Boards for All. The report looked at the gender and geography of more than 2,000 board members across 146 global health organizations. Among the findings, only a quarter of those seats were held by people from low and middle income countries, despite these countries being home to 83% of the world's population. Only 1% of board members were women from low income countries. Nearly half the organizations evaluated had boards composed entirely of people from high-income countries. That's half of them. Yikes. I knew there was inequality, but the magnitude of it was shocking, said Dr. Catherine Kiyobutunga, executive director of the African Population and Health Research Center. For example, the statistic that more than 880 board seats out of 2,000 are occupied by Americans. That's 44% from one single country. How is that possible? This illustrates how bad the system is. This is not really global health. Okay, we're going to move on to racial disparities, and this first one is about basic foundation of health, which is sleep. This from Science Daily. Study finds persistent racial and ethnic disparities in sleep duration. Using data collected from the National Health Interview Survey from 2004 to 2018, researchers found that the proportion of people who reported sleeping fewer than 7 hours per day increased significantly over a 15-year period, and it was significantly higher among black people. As an indicator of sleep health, adequate sleep duration is essential for achieving and maintaining a healthy life, said lead author Dr. Cesar Caraballo Cardoves, postdoctoral associate in the Yale-based Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation. The current expert consensus is that most adults should get between 7 and 9 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period, and we found that black people on average were persistently less likely to report sleeping such recommended duration. Specifically, we found that over the 15 years we analyzed, black people had the highest prevalence of both short sleep duration, that's fewer than 7 hours, and long sleep duration, more than 9 hours. The Yale-led team reported that in 2018, the percentage of people reporting short sleep duration was 11 points higher among black people when compared to white people. The same disparity was 7.5 points in 2004. They investigated how these findings varied by sex and household income and found that the disparities were the highest for black women and black individuals with middle or high incomes. There were also differences between racial and ethnic groups when sleep duration was analyzed by age. For instance, they found that the disparities were the highest for young and middle-aged black adults, slightly narrowing among the elderly. This suggests that factors related to working or employment conditions are disproportionately preventing black individuals from having adequate sleep. Sleep is closely related to overall physical and mental health, said the senior author Harlan Krumholtz, professor of medicine at Yale. Both short sleep and long sleep duration are associated with higher risk of suffering adverse medical events, including higher risk of death, he said. Thus, the persistent sleep disparities for black people may be contributing to persistent average worse health status among black people. There should be renewed efforts to eliminate the socioeconomic and health conditions that prevent minoritized racial and ethnic individuals from achieving adequate sleep, including racism. And another story about racial disparities is from the Washington Post. Fewer patients of color have healthcare providers who look like them. When you look at your doctor, who looks back at you? That could depend on your race and affect the quality of care you receive. Only 22% of black adults and 29% of Hispanic and Latino adults surveyed considered their usual healthcare providers to share their race or ethnicity. And about a quarter of Hispanic and Latino respondents said their providers are the same race or ethnicity and speaks to them using their preferred language. A diverse medical workforce does more than check a box for inclusion. Patients with providers of their race or ethnicity and who speak their language report better outcomes and are more likely to be prescribed preventive care. Language is a particular barrier. Patients whose providers speak their language are more likely to receive what they see as quality care and report better communication. Trust is part of the foundation of good patient-provider relationships and is especially important for communities of color who have long been discriminated against in healthcare, Jacqueline Orr, a program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which funded the study, said in a statement, having a provider who looks like you and shares your experiences builds trust. Yes, trust is the social glue that holds together, and trust is a public health issue. Okay, well, I wanted to end my reporting today with a little bit of a better note. This is an example of where public health works. This is from MedPage Today. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force lung cancer screening recommendations tied to thousands fewer deaths. Significantly more cases of early non-small cell lung cancer were caught following the introduction of low-dose CT screening recommendations nearly a decade ago. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in 2013 recommended low-dose CT for high-risk current and former smokers. The researchers calculated that due to a shift toward earlier stages of disease from 2014 to 2018, these improvements in survival averted an estimated 10,100 deaths. Although the adoption of lung cancer screening has been slow and screening rates have remained low nationally, the findings of the study indicate the beneficial effect that even a small amount of screening can have on lung cancer stage shifts and survival at the population level. And of course, folks, the best way to prevent lung cancer deaths is to not take up smoking or quit smoking if you are smoking. If you're a current smoker and you need help with that, you can call the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, there's always more to report, and I have 10 bonus articles for you today. This is a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. First up, America is staring down its first so what wave. The United States could be in for a double whammy, a surge it cares to neither measure nor respond to. Two, the FDA chief lists 6 steps to improve health outcomes. Evidence development and the public health data systems are on Califf's fix-it list. 3. Vaccine resistance has its roots in negative childhood experiences, a major study finds. 4. Why black and Hispanic seniors are often left with a less powerful flu vaccine. 5. The CDC can do better. 5 former directors on room for improvement. 6. The U.S. still doesn't know how to track a pandemic. The story is from the website 538.com, and there are a bunch of data freaks, and they give a really good history about our successes and failures in tracking the pandemic. And 7, on a little better note, the successful failures of Apollo 13 and COVID-19 vaccination. Of course, the quick development of vaccinations was a really good thing, but also, this has been the quickest we've received this level of vaccination in the entire population for a largely non-mandated vaccination. So while I complain a lot about vaccination rates being low, it actually is a record of sorts. 8. EPA moves to ban asbestos after decades of failures. It's the first time EPA has flexed its regulatory muscles under the revamped Toxic Substances Control Act. 9. Orphaned by gun violence. 2 kids, 2 shootings, 2 parents gone. Every day in America, more than 40 children lose a parent to shootings. 10. The grief pill is coming. If you yearn or pine too long for your dead child, partner, spouse, or friend, you may be addicted to grief, according to a new revision of the diagnostic manual. Oh my God, we have to medicalize and pathologize everything, even the natural process of grieving. And of course, if you define it as a problem, they'll develop a pill for it. You can read these and all the other ones, articles that I reported in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.